Hi, I'm Jamie Poisson. Last month, the New York State Pension Fund made an announcement. They were pulling their money out of seven Canadian companies in the oil sands.
Well, I think they want to send the message that they take climate change seriously, and they want to, you know, show all of their stakeholders that they are trying to change their portfolio so that it's more aligned with, you know, low carbon choices.
That's my colleague Kyle Bax. He's a business reporter in Calgary, and today we're going to be talking about how some major financial institutions are choosing to divest from the oil patch and how it's a bit more complicated than it may seem at first glance. Starting with this example of a major U.S. public pension fund, the third largest in the country.
There were a lot of environmental groups that were pretty excited about this announcement. You know, they really played up that here is another big name investment firm that has pretty deep pockets, and it is choosing to turn its back on the oil sands. When you really look, though, at deep into the announcement, it's a bit more complex than that. There's more layers to it. So the fund decided to pull out more than $7 million US out of seven different companies. And really, in the grand scheme of things, that's not a lot of money. These are companies that are worth billions of dollars. So $7 million, it's a pretty small amount. And really what happened was is that they didn't fully pull out of the oil sands. What they did is they took a look at all the different oil sands companies that they were currently investing in, and they evaluated each one. So they looked at how these companies are spending their money. Do they have a strategy for transitioning to lower carbon sources of energy? Do they have environmental targets? What kind of a strategy do they have to reach those kinds of targets? So they decided to pull out of seven different companies, but they kept their funding in Suncor Energy. And It was really interesting because they have more than $19 million invested in Suncor.
Okay, so more than what they pulled out.
Exactly. And so really, is this big pension fund pulling out of the oil sands? Not really. You know, the majority of the cash that they have invested in the oil sands is staying in the oil sands.
What was their reasoning for staying with Suncor, for having this $19 million stay with Suncor?
They didn't give a specific reason, but based on the rationale for why they pulled out of the other companies, you know, you can gather that they see Suncor as showing signs that it can still be a player in a low carbon economic transition. We see with Suncor, it's already investing in wind farms. It's done that for 20 years. The oil sands is still their main source of production, definitely. But they're also investing in, you know, carbon capture and technology projects. And they're also investing in, you know, cleaner sources of jet fuel.
What does this one example of the New York State Pension Fund tell you about this move by some financial institutions to start divesting from the oil sands?
I think it says a lot of different things. I think on one hand, when you divest from the oil sands or divest from fossil fuels, it sends a pretty loud message. I also think it shows how this is a really complex issue. You saw with this example how, you know, on one hand, they saw that they can make an environmental difference by pulling out of some companies, but they still see value in investing in the oil sands. They still see value in investing in the energy sector. And that's probably reflective of society, where we're at. You know, the world is still heavily dependent on oil and on natural gas.
This is one example of a trend you've been watching. I wonder if you could tell me more about this broader divestment trend. What have you been seeing?
You know, it's really interesting. It started, I'd say, probably about a decade ago, and it was really small. It was like small church groups were deciding not to invest in oil and gas and the coal sector. And then it started to grow. And then you had, you know, university students that were kind of raising this issue, lobbying, you know, their universities to take a stand and not invest in fossil fuels.
We're from U of T 350, and we are going to barge through this classroom at Convocation Hall in solidarity action with Dal Housie.
Dal, for the best, now put fossil fuels to rest.
And in the last few years, now you're seeing some of these really big players like BlackRock, like the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who are taking a similar path. And I spoke with Keith Stewart about this. He's the senior energy strategist with Greenpeace Canada. And he says that in the last 6 or 7 years, there's been enormous momentum towards this movement.
And now there's actually a global movement to try and get cut off the money pipeline to sort of the big banks, the big pension funds, to sort of say, you guys have got to, you know, get out of fossil fuels. And I mean, if you look at since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, the federal government has invested $60 billion in its climate strategy. The big five banks in Canada have put $700 billion into fossil fuels. I mean, the scale of this, the sort of the money that's flowing in there now is incredible. And if we could actually get that money directed towards climate solutions rather than sort of extracting and burning more fossil fuels, we could make a huge difference.
And I thought that was really interesting because, of course, in the last few years, we've seen environmental activists targeting pipelines as a way to stop growth in the oil industry. If you can stop pipelines, then it's pretty hard for the oil industry to grow. But now you're seeing this different strategy. They're targeting the money pipeline. So they're targeting banks, insurance companies, just the broader financial sector.
A few of the people chained themselves to the front door of the head office of Liberty Mutual Insurance. Others held signs and chanted for the government to stop the TMX pipeline.
And so if they're able to stop this money pipeline, the financial support for the sector, that's a way of stifling the industry and making sure that it's a real challenge for the industry to grow.
You just mentioned how this sort of goes beyond pension funds, right? You mentioned insurance companies as well. And talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, this is pretty interesting. And it's not a topic that really gets a lot of attention. But what's happened is, in recent years in particular, oil sands companies and pipeline companies are having a real tough time getting adequate insurance for their projects. And this came up recently with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. So this is the pipeline that's the expansion pipeline that's being constructed from Alberta to the BC West Coast. And so this is a Crown corporation. It's owned by the federal government. And Trans Mountain was having a tough time not only getting insurance, but what was happening is that some demonstrators in Vancouver were blocking the entrances of buildings that house insurance companies.
Indigenous youth are inside.
So these activists were trying to raise this issue, trying to demonstrate against these insurance companies that are providing coverage to this project.
Huh.
And Trans Mountain asked the regulator to keep the names confidential of the companies that are providing insurance to it. And Trans Mountain basically made the argument to the regulator that it's becoming so hard to find insurance companies that want to support their pipeline project. It's becoming more expensive and it's harder just to get enough coverage for the facility. And we're seeing this with oil sands companies too. With their big multi-billion-dollar facilities, they're having a tough time getting enough insurance.
And this probably sounds like a very obvious question, but what are they needing the insurance for?
Well, if you're going to, let's say, an investor in an oil sands company and this oil sands company wants to build a new facility, you want to make sure that there's some assurance that your investment, it's not going to go up in smoke if there is a fire, let's say, at this facility. Or for a pipeline company, you want insurance so that if there's a huge spill and there's massive costs to clean it up and other related expenses, that there's some sort of coverage that'll cover that big expense.
Hmm. So like essentially these companies need the insurance, right? Like they just can't not get insurance.
Absolutely. And with Trans Mountain, they even spelled it out that it's mandatory for their company. as the way that they operate, and it's mandatory even that the regulator insists that they have enough insurance.
Even though the regulator let the insurer stay secret, I wonder if the environmentalists saw this still as a victory.
Absolutely, they did. Yeah, and I spoke with some of these environmental groups that are around the world, and even though they weren't even part of this case, they definitely picked up on what was happening. I spoke with Alana Sulakshana. She's with the Rainforest Action Network. It's an environmental organization based in San Francisco. And, you know, she could only smile when she was talking about it, basically saying it's a huge sign that the pressure on these insurance companies is working. And, you know, that's basically what her job is as part of the Rainforest Action Network, is to put pressure on these companies to stop supporting the fossil fuel industry.
In the past 1-2 years, we've seen an increasing spotlight on financial institutions as pillars of the fossil fuel industry, increasing kind of recognition that it's not just big oil and gas companies and coal companies that have to reduce their emissions, that financiers and insurers are also responsible for kind of zeroing out emissions to achieve the Paris Agreement. And we're seeing that kind of increased recognition from civil society, politicians, investors, and executives within the financial industry as well. There's actually a coalition in the US that came together a year and a half ago called Stop the Money Pipeline, which aims to bring together kind of all of these campaigns on financial institutions into a kind of broader movement to, you know, build our collective power.
We spoke earlier about the $7 million the New York State pension fund was pulling out of the oil sands, and how it was kind of a pittance. It's not a huge amount of money, but do we have a sense of the scale of the divestment at this point? If you start to put it all together, just how many insurance companies as well are refusing to insure companies in the oil sands?
It's a great question. And, you know, it's something I was really grappling with and trying to find definitive numbers for. And it's difficult because, you know, some insurance companies will completely pull out their money from the oil sands. Others, you know, they'll have certain stipulations. So if the oil sands only makes up, let's say, 20 or 30% of your business, they'll still provide you coverage. So it's difficult to come up with a definitive number. But I can say, about a decade ago, there were about 50 large insurance companies in North America, Europe, and Bermuda that provided coverage to the oil sands. And I spoke to Joe Seeger. He has more than 25 years of experience advising oil patch companies on insurance. And he says today, there's only about half as many insurance companies. So instead of 50, there's, you know, about 25 or 30 that are left that are actually providing insurance to the oil sands.
Huh. Wow. That's a big difference. What would be the more cynical reason why a financial institution might make this kind of move to get out of the oil sands?
It might be just about improving your reputation, for sure. You know, there are some financial risks. You know, right now the oil patch is doing very well. You know, it's making a lot of money. So for some investors, they want to stick with the fossil fuel industry just purely out of financial reasons. But there is some financial risk. You know, no investor wants to be left with a stranded asset. You don't want to have all your money in, let's say, an oil sands company. And, you know, the world basically shifts off of oil. I don't know when that'll be, 5, 10, 15, 20, maybe even longer now. But you don't want to be left with a stranded asset. So there is some financial risk long term that if you keep your money in the oil patch, that's a possibility.
Important question here is, if the goal of these environmental groups pushing this is to stymie the expansion of the oil sands, is it working? What effect has this divestment movement been having here?
you know, we do hear about these divestment announcements by various funds. You know, they happen periodically. And every time it happens, you know, it's hard to make a big deal out of just one announcement. But cumulatively, when you add them all up, it's definitely having an impact. I asked Mark Little about that. He's the chief executive of Suncor Energy, a big oil sands player, also owns the Petro-Canada chain. And he said, yes, it's making a difference.
I think if you go and look at the percentage of the oil industry and you compare it to its percentage of the marketplace and the stock market and such going forward, it's kind of like, okay, the industry is just literally a fraction of what it was before. The businesses are still generating a lot of cash. So I would say, yes, it's having an impact. But part of the thing is, I think that the world is kind of realizing that, okay, this is way more complicated. Like, it's so, how are we going to make cement? How is steel going to be made with no CO2 emissions? What does this mean for long haul airlines trying to fly 300 people across the ocean? It's kind of like, well, a wind farm can't be the solution to every problem. It's not.
And so we. But he also sees this as a pretty complex issue, and he doesn't think that weakening the oil patch is necessarily a good thing. He sees the energy sector as being pretty critical for the future. You know, how is the world going to transition to cleaner sources of energy? Who's going to build these, you know, massive new projects that we'll need? Maybe that's electricity storage projects. Maybe that's more transmission lines. Maybe that's using hydrogen. So he sees the oil patch as playing a pretty critical role. You know, just considering all the expertise that the oil patch has, all the engineers, and so on.
But do you think it's possible that these moves to divest and the pressure and even the consequence of some investors divesting could really like push these companies to change quicker?
It could. You know, when I talk to investors, they basically say there's like two main strategies. You know, one is divestment, as we've talked about. The other is remaining as a stakeholder, but using that position to push for change. You know, you have a seat at the table, and so you can leverage that to try to push for environmental change. I spoke with Alex Letko about that. He's a partner with Letko Brosseau, an investment firm here in Canada that manages $19 billion in assets. He says every money manager in the world is hearing from clients about this issue. And his firm just finished asking itself the big question, should we still be investing in oil? So the firm did an analysis. They looked at electric vehicle trends. They also looked at forecasts for the amount of oil used in many industries, such as marine shipping and plastic production. At the same time, the group considered the ethics, describing climate change as an urgent problem, posing an existential threat to our livelihoods. In the end, they decided to stay the course, at least for now.
And so really for us, it's about, you know, what is our place as investors and as stewards of capital, and what is the best thing that we can do and the greatest difference that we can make. And so, you know, we believe that actually having a voice at the table is more conducive to positive change than not.
Now, that said, the world is always changing. So the firm is going to keep evaluating that stance as technology changes and just as the world changes.
As you mentioned before, the world is still super dependent on oil. And I wonder if there might be some unintended consequences, a move away from the Canadian oil sands too.
You know, it's really interesting. If you think about where oil comes from around the world, most of it comes from state-owned producers. So think about, you know, these state-owned companies in Russia and Saudi Arabia and many other countries. So there is some thought that if you squeeze out oil and gas companies in North America and Europe, then you're left with state-owned producers. And this raises some geopolitical issues.
And how do the environmental groups respond to that?
Well, for them, they say that they're lobbying both sides of the equation, both supply and demand. So they're trying to keep oil from coming out of the ground, but they're also trying to lobby for society to be less dependent on oil and gas. So they're trying to promote, let's say, electric vehicles instead of, you know, the traditional vehicles running on gas and diesel. So they see it as trying to push both sides of the equation, not just trying to oppose oil and gas companies, but also with that, also trying to make sure that society is changing as well.
Hmm. The next UN climate summit, COP26, is in November. The UK is hosting. And the former Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney has been brought in as an advisor. I understand he said that part of the meeting will focus on how the private financial sector can take climate change into account when making their financial decisions. And I wonder, just before we say goodbye, Kyle, where do you think that this is going?
The pressure on banks and other financial institutions, it's not going away. And Jamie, when firms do decide to turn their backs on the sector, it's usually permanent. It's pretty rare for them to change their minds.
Okay. All right, Kyle, thank you so much. This is such an interesting discussion. We're really, really appreciative to have you on the podcast.
My pleasure.
All right, that is all for this week. Front Burner is brought to you by CBC News and CBC Podcasts. The show is produced this week by Imogen Burchard, Elaine Chow, Shannon Higgins, and Ali Janes, and Mariam Kacha. Our sound design was by Derek Vanderwijk and Devin Nguyen and Mackenzie Cameron. Our music is by Joseph Shabison of Boombox Sound. The executive producer of Front Burner is Nick McCabe-Locos. I'm Jamie Poisson. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you on Monday.